This is MR Radio, I'm GW, and I have Daniel online as usual. Our guest today is a true comrade and stalwart of the nationalist movement, who I've known and counted as a friend for over a decade, but who's probably as well known in and central to the movement as anybody anywhere. He is the author and speaker, thinker and activist, Dr. Tomislav Sunic, but to everyone who knows him, he is Tom. Tom, thanks very much for agreeing to an interview. This is your third for the site. And I hope we can produce the best yet.
Thank you very much. I'm pleased to be here. And my best wishes to your listeners.
Okay, I'll jump straight in. Of everybody I know, probably you have more connection to the movement in Europe and in America. I think you're pretty unique in that respect. And I hope that you will therefore be in a position where you can pass on some interesting opinions on the question of the state of political nationalism. We're all obviously trying to advance our cause, and it's a great struggle because there are so many mighty problems that confront European man in this particular day and age. But there has been a degree of softening up of the opposition in some areas. We've seen political breakthroughs over the last 2 to 3 years, particularly in France, in Holland, in Denmark, in Finland. And so, I mean, on the surface of it, this seems to be something that's moving forward, but also there's been a degree of accommodationism. It's been bought at a cost. I wonder what your view on the general situation is or where it might develop from here.
All right. Well, there are a couple of things we have to sort out. First, we got to define exactly this word nationalism. Secondly, we have to make a clear distinction between, as you said, political nationalism, meaning the nationalism which is more or less mainstream, quote unquote, which is more or less within the system, and intellectual nationalism, namely the one that like me and you and many other folks are simply sympathetic to, but without belonging to any specific party in Europe, or for that matter in the United States of America. So let's start first with a definition. As I certainly know, and I always like harping on this, on those semantic deviations and those semantic distortions, rather. The word nationalism, unfortunately, still has a very rather bad odor, so to speak. Some folks prefer to use the word patriotism. Some folks, like, for instance, the young identitarianists in France, they use the word, which is very specifically French, identité. Yes. So I'm a little bit at loss exactly what exactly and who exactly is precising and defining this word, and what this word specifically means in France, for that matter, or in Croatia, for that matter, or in Wales, or for that matter, in Scotland. So I guess we have to be very, very careful and avoid using across-the-board nouns, unless those nouns specifically refer to a given historical place and position.
But in the political context, Tom, are we not really a little more open-minded as to what qualifies as nationalism? In a way, any kind of progress, perhaps apart from civic nationalist progress, but any kind of progress, no matter whether it's identitarian in the French sense, the bloc identité, or whether it is racial nationalist or ethno-nationalist, is still progress. And in a sense, are we not able to say, well, let's be kind to all of these things and let's take what profit we can and we'll sort out the details later?
You are quite right. And let me re-quote you, beggars can't be choosers. So I have to put up with this insignia and with this name calling, whether I like it or not. Even if it's worse, even if it gains momentum in a negative direction. So I'm sort of used to people calling me, he's a white nationalist, he's a racist, he is a neo-Nazi. So I don't give a damn about those words. So I nonetheless, let me just put it bluntly, I do not define myself as a nationalist because I think the word is outdated. But well, let's stick for the time being now with this word nationalist, because by and large, this word is in usage all over the world, all over our world. I have to put up with this word despite the fact, and if I can just make a little digression, I start with from the premises that nationalism has, by and large, over the last 100 years, been a very, very bad for all of us. or be they English or Scottish or German or Serbs or Croats or Ukrainians right now fighting in eastern Ukraine against the Russian nationalists. So this is my first and very major conclusion. Nationalism, the way we have known it for quite some time, has been, to say the least, very, very bad. It has had negative consequences for all of us. Now, coming back to the second point that you have just mentioned, as far as political nationalism, well-established nationalism is concerned, there is no question that it has had quite a bit of success, particularly in France. Look what's happening with the Front National. Just the other day, I spent some time with some high representatives of French nationalists in Moscow. I'm not going to go into details for obvious reasons, but there are some, and I'm pretty much pleased, I'll tell you, that the French nationalists around Madame Marine Le Pen, regardless of her accommodating endeavors, that's something we can also approach a little bit, as I said a while ago. They have had some very, very serious, they made some serious progress. Mm. So I'm not ruling out that the nationalists may be forming, maybe, or might be forming a government in France 2 years from now during the next presidential elections. The same goes for Jobbik. I know those people rather well. I was twice their guest. This is just next door here in Hungary, in Budapest, about 250 miles from where I live. So I certainly respect those people. They have some very high-powered intellectuals. They have about 16 seats in the parliament, and they certainly command respect even among people who do not like them. So let's leave aside, you know, the value judgment. The fact of the matter is that the nationalist scene, quote-unquote nationalist, is gaining momentum, that people are simply dissatisfied. And it's the point we gotta underline. People, by and large, be they in Catalonia, or for that matter in England, or for that matter in Scotland, or for that matter in Flanders, I was there also a couple of weeks ago, they are fed up with the mainstream parties, regardless whether those mainstream parties call themselves Christian Democrats or Social Democratic parties. It's just these are the parties of the system that have been totally debunked. I should say that in a rather euphemistic fashion. They have been, in fact, they have defaulted on their own people. So yeah. No wonder that those, again, nationalist parties all over Europe are gaining momentum. Except for the thing that I mentioned earlier, I'm not happy with this terminology. I'm not quite happy with this negative identity, and I'm
sure
we're going to tackle that.
Can I ask something about
that?
Sure. Since you're unhappy with the term nationalism, my question would be to someone who has such misgivings that it seems to me that would be the unit of accountability. Once you go beyond nationalism and into the race or whatever, it's going to become unwieldy. The matter of accountability. Instead of nationalism to manage these different populations of Europeans.
Well, it's such a good point indeed that you have made, Daniel. But again, I'm puzzled and I'm disarmed, so to say, with your question, because I don't know which synonym to come up with.
Probably isn't the aspect of nationalism that bothers you not really nationalism but imperialism, where they're attacking the neighboring countries.
Okay.
And I mean, this thing that's happening in Ukraine, is that really nationalism, or is that Jewish interests and corporate interests using Ukrainian nationalism against Russia?
These are two points that you have singled out, and I fully agree. We can also look at the quote-unquote the real Jewish influence in Ukraine and in manipulating or handling those various nationalist parties, or would-be nationalist parties, but it's a separate matter. What I'm basically saying, and I just want to make it perfectly clear, we would need to overhaul our lingo, entirely our lingo, in order to come up with some value-free assessments of what nationalism is all about. The word nationalism has nowadays a very negative connotation. That's the first point, despite the fact that I may like it or dislike it. The second point I would like to harp on, and I guess this is something we have to look at in our show, is this negative identity. I call it negative identity or negative legitimacy. Let's take, okay, this is closer to home. Let's take this fact of Serbian Croatian nationalists. I'll give you a straight example. On the day-to-day example, I can't talk literally to any Croatian nationalist here, and there is not a single one who defines his nationalism in terms of positive values. Okay, let me just reverse the argument. Most nationalism, most nationalists that I encounter here in Croatia, it's a small country, by the way, everybody knows everybody, define their nationalism on the basis of excluding the Serbs. Or for that matter, look at the Catalans. They, of course, I have a great deal of sympathy for them, but they also define their nationalism on the basis of excluding the Spaniards, the Castilians, for that matter, or the Gallegos, the Galicians. Or let's look, for instance, the German nationalist, and it probably doesn't come that often, but I call it negative legitimacy. Of course, you live in Poland, so you know very well that the Polish nationalists and the German nationalists, and I know quite a few of them, and I deeply respect. But once it comes to some nitty-gritty details like the history of Posen, the history of Gdansk or Danzig, or the history, let's say, of Teutonic Knights or whatever, then things really get awful.
But Tom, I have to comment on that because it's so important, and it's getting a bit out of hand in white nationalism. I think that these kind of heated disputes are something that mostly circulates among very people with very specialized concerns and largely amongst white nationalists and maybe historians, because in 15 years in Poland, I have never once heard a Polish person initiate a conversation disparaging Germans in any way, saying anything bad about Germans. It's not in currency. It's not something that's discussed. I heard David Duke saying just in his last podcast, "Oh, I know that Polish people are angry with Germans." No, they're not. None of this is anything to do with what normal people are thinking and doing. It's something that's stirred up in white nationalists. I don't know whether they get money or audience by saying this crap, but there's no big conflict between the people like that. Not at all. As a matter of fact, when I first came to Poland, I experimented with teasing that out with the people that, what is it with these Germans starting all these wars? And it didn't go anywhere. It was like, I was looked upon as if I'm quaint or something. It's just not anti-German sentiment. It's just not here. Not in my experience.
And these are good news. What you are telling me, it's really beautiful news, and I'd like to hear more of it. Unfortunately, you always have to look at the other side. If you read not just the nationalist podcasts, you listen to a nationalist podcast in Germany. If you talk to people in Germany, and I know them rather well, this is like my second homeland, this issue of Posen, this issue of quote-unquote Poland having, taken one-third of the German lands and so on.
They didn't take it, it was given.
That's precisely the argument I'm trying to avoid, because I hear it almost on the daily basis. My fellow Croats, they're literally obsessed with anti-Serbian resentments.
Poland didn't take one third of the German land. Germany had part of Poland as per Frederick the Great's territorial aggrandizement, and if you're talking about Versailles, you're talking about four cities basically. Posen, Bydgoszcz, Toruń, and Danzig. Half of Danzig, and Danzig was made neutral. So three cities, and that was it. And Hitler starting this war under the pretext of these four cities. And I do mean pretext. Listen to the last table talk that Carolyn Jaeger reads, and Hitler's talking about smashing to oblivion Petersburg and Moscow. He said this has to be done. Poland is already history in his mind. It's not. Everybody knew that he planned to take over these Eastern European nations. It wasn't. I mean, David Duke is saying, "Oh, he made very reasonable offers to England." That's all nonsense. Everybody knows that Hitler wanted to take over lands up to the Urals.
We don't want to fall into this trap, Daniel. I fully agree with you, but this is unfortunately. This issue, and let's just focus on this broader issue, on this more general theoretical issue. This is unfortunately the problem with the heritage of nationalism, be it here in the Balkans, be it in the Baltic countries. It's certainly no accident. Let me just give you another example. I certainly don't want to interject in your comments, which are quite plausible. There is no question about that. But look at let me just give you a further example of this negative identity, which unfortunately, I must repeat over and over again, which unfortunately comes from this old 19th, 20th century type nationalism. You have, for instance, in the battalion, Azov battalion, I'm sure you've heard about this, the quote-unquote neo-Nazi battalion now fighting officially under the Ukrainian flag against the Russian nationalists. down in eastern Ukraine. Unfortunately, I must say, I must repeat again the word unfortunately. You have about 20 Croatian nationalists fighting on the Ukrainian side. You had some Polish nationalists there. You had some Estonian nationalists. You have also some French nationalists fighting against the volunteers who are on the Russian side, also coming from Serbia this time, some from Spain, some from Italy. And this is what I find abhorring, because I ask,
it is abhorrent.
I'll tell you why I find it abhorring. Now we come to your point. Now we come to the point. Who benefits from this? Who benefits from all those quarrels? From those quarrels between Scotland and Ireland? We can now delve into history. You're quite right. We can start with Sienkiewicz or Pribyszewski. We can quote all those masterpieces by Polish authors. We can just as well, produce all this intellectual artillery by German nationalists. I'm trying. I'll tell you quite openly. I don't want your listeners to consider me a good Samaritan. I'm just trying to do the best to fight for our European, if you wish, white cause, for our heritage, not just biological heritage, for our cultural heritage, regardless whether your listeners are from Poland or Serbia or from Greece, for that matter. This is something we have to look at. And hence the reason I started first with this introductory note about the etymology of the word nationalism, which, again, who benefits? And we know deadly well who benefits from this conflict in eastern Ukraine, for that matter. And when we quarrel between us, when the Spanish nationalists, when they quarrel with the Catalanian nationalists, or for that matter, when the Serbian nationalists are quarreling with the Croatian nationalists, I always ask myself a question, who benefits? And we know very well who benefits from those tragic events.
Can I just say, from my point of view, this, because I'm an English nationalist, and to the fury probably of lots of others, but the English nationalists don't have any bones to pick really with other peoples.
It's not except for the Irish.
We don't. No, they have a bone to pick with us. It's the dispensation in the United Kingdom is that the Welsh, the Scots, and the Irish, who've been in and out of the United Kingdom, are very, very antipathetic to the English cause. And in one case, the Scots case, certainly, there is a tendency for Scottish nationalists to identify themselves against the English. That's a fact, and you're quite right about that. But it is not something which is a characteristic of English nationalism in any way. We just go about our own sweet way and leave them to it. We can't do anything about it. We can't stop them thinking like that. It's their problem. But anyway, what I was trying to say is that this is natural. If we can call this ethnic nationalism is not in itself an active force in normal historical moments. It is something which just hums along beneath the surface, and fundamentally it only operates as a kind of brake upon the excesses of the elites, or it generally guides the elites and the political class to include within their workings the interests of the people at large. It is only when something happens that the interests of the people at large are no longer represented, or that the interests of the people at large have come under attack from without. It's only under one or other of those that ethnic nationalism turns into a much more aggressive force. And what you're talking about is really the aftermath of that event, of that turning event. So you're saying, well, yes, okay, in Croatia, it's how about, identifying yourself against the Serbs? Yes, but that's an aftermath of a very, very long and deep historical tragedy. And the same between Poland and Germany, although what Daniel is saying is rather encouraging about that. So I don't think that one should necessarily say this is nationalism. It's a problem of nationalism, because actually nationalism does not need, in ordinary times, to have this very, very aggressive and, whether it's imperialistic or not, this very, very aggressive format. It can operate quite contentedly as a general influence and break, and that is enough. And you wouldn't even say that it was there. It just hums away. That's the way I see it.
My natural first disposition towards Germans in Germany would be to say, we've got to help those Germany secure its borders, make sure that its population is 97-98% of its native own.
Yes.
And not only that, Germany's not enough, because we've got to set up German communities and German-speaking and cultural communities in South America and North America, on other continents as well. That would be where I'm coming from, how I want to do things.
Yeah, well, that's a beneficial ethnic nationalism. I can see
I don't. It's not a kind of attitude that's coming out of American white nationalists.
No, it isn't. But that's one of the problems, and Tom is, you know, obviously concerned about that, and it's something that you're concerned about. You know, this is a Salterian thing. There should be a generosity, a universalist outlook.
I like all the Europeans and all their
we want all of us to succeed, and we want all peoples everywhere. I mean, we want to grant them what we would have them grant us, and you know that's the way it should actually function. All peoples of the land have the right in nature to struggle for life on that land. That is a direct flow down from, you know, nature's own imperative to transmit genes for fitness, for fitness traits, through time. It's what we are here as ecologists to actually do. And the repository for genes for fitness is the ethnic group. So there's a sort of Salterian argument in this, which commends universalism. So what we have perhaps here is a contest which exists between a universalist outlook and a highly particularist outlook. The highly particularist outlook perhaps having been generated out of historical necessity, or in any way out of historical considerations, and you know, hanging around longer than perhaps it really needs to. That's the way I would see it as an English nationalist, but there we go.
That's a good point you've made indeed. And I guess, again, let me just be a little bit more specific in terms of our terminology. You're using the word ethnic nationalism. Let's use the opposite of it, racial nationalism,
yes.
Not in a negative sense. You know, for some reasons, it seems to me that's probably the irony of history. And the more I'm staying now in Europe, the more I find the advantages of quote-unquote white European nationalism in the United States of America, where most white nationalists, at least people I know, including some top-notch intellectuals, academics, who don't explicitly define themselves as white nationalists, but who are certainly good white Americans, we can say. Yes. They are certainly less obsessed with those tribal issues, not in a negative sense, with this historical quote-unquote memory, with the historical narrative, all those big words and all those big historiographies that we've been permeated with here in Europe, from Poland all the way down to the Balkans. So I guess that's probably one issue, as opposed to ethnic nationalism, which certainly is full of culture. I'm probably joking, I'm probably caricaturing a little bit, full of transcendence, if you wish. But unfortunately, this transcendence has cost a great many, many lives here in Europe, all over Europe, over the last 100 years, including the latest issue, so to say, in eastern Ukraine. So I guess I do see some hope, you know, if I can just put it tentatively, even in the United States of America. Of course, there are different problems over there. They probably lack this ethnic culture, what the Germans say, Kulturvolk, you know, it just cannot be translated into English. It literally means not just culture people. It means something that you have a deep-rooted genesis. Yes. of your people. And unfortunately in America this is lacking. Now, despite the fact that I must say, on a personal level, I'm very pleased when I am with my folks, when I have fellows in America, and when I discuss with them, this issue of whether Croats had this victimhood of 200,000 people killed in this particular historical epoch, or whether the number was less than that, simply never comes to their mind. And you know, I just have a normal discussion. So I guess the issue, I would certainly prefer our European folks, be they in France now, be they in Flanders, or be it in Wallonia, be it in Ireland, or for that matter in Scotland, the issues I would like our folks to look at here in Europe is namely this massive non-European immigration and dissolution or dilution of our gene pool. This is something we have to look at. And this is this pan-European nationalism under quotation marks that I would really like to see take some shape in Europe.
But there has been accommodationism, hasn't there, across the political nationalist European world. where there's been perhaps progress made electorally, but at the cost of talking less about that particular issue. Marine Le Pen, for example, has identified the great enemy as globalism. She said this is a contest in our time between globalism and nationalism. That's how she's described it. So she's not risking too much on the racial question.
Absolutely, I fully agree with you.
And also, I mean, the discourse against Islam, you know, Islam is a proxy for the racial question. We all realize that.
Absolutely.
But, you know, a lot of people who are taken in by that, and you see it, and I spend quite a bit of time looking at newspaper threads, and there's a great deal of anger about Islam that gets put onto a thread, but, nobody really wants to exhibit the real cause of their anger, which is, you know, foreign peoples, not simply a foreign faith. And, there's been a certain cost, which at some point or other has got to be faced up to, and things have to be corrected. But perhaps that can't be done until the movement has made a lot more progress.
You're quite right. Again, you're using the word accommodationism. I guess let's put it bluntly, David. This is another euphemism. We can probably use the more the blunter word, which is sellout. You're quite right. I can call it, okay, let me use a nice metaphor. I'm sure you will understand what that means. The road to Damascus, the road to Damascus. So we can rather call it the road to Tel Aviv, to be a little bit more explicit, You had this pilgrimage of different nationalist honchos from different parties in Austria, including FPÖ, and also some folks from Front National, and including Geert Wilders. Of course, we know very well how he breathes. Mm-hmm. They, to some extent, have to make this symbolic atonement figure to Israel in order to sort of buy out some extra time. What's actually crossing the mind, their mind, and what's crossing the mind of their Jewish or Israeli interlocutors is an entirely different ballgame. So we understand the game. We know very well what the stakes are here. I mean, to some extent, you can also draw the parallel with Paul Rand in the United States of America, and even some other quote-unquote nationalist little movements who would certainly like to gain some more credibility in denouncing this the flooding of America with non-Europeans, and who think that prior to their the successful campaign in denouncing and in fact pointing out this danger of multiculturalism and the danger of the breakup of the United States of America, that they must first and foremost pay some homage to the Jewish cause. Yes. And on the psychological level, it's quite comprehensible. And this is probably one of the reasons why I don't belong to any specific, I have colleagues and friends and I respect, for colleagues in all over Europe, but I certainly don't want to belong to any specific party. First, because of the reason that I mentioned earlier, and secondly, because I simply think I don't want to sell out. Mm. And I am certainly very much bothered with this token Jewishness. Let's have our good token Jewishness in order to gain some parliamentarian credibility, and then we'll be able to fight quote-unquote Islam. And you're quite right, it's not just Islam.
There's none of that tokenism here at Majority Rights.
No, but you're quite right. I mean, I just want to make sure we understand we're on the same wavelength as far as the terminology is concerned.
Yeah.
You notice that I'm certainly not very happy with what, for instance, the FPÖ, this Freedom Party in Austria next door, has been going through. They've become very, very mainstream. They've toned down their rhetoric completely. Of course, now, instead of using more harsh words, instead of even using the J word, if you wish, they certainly are using a popular word against Islam, because let's say this anti-Islamic hysteria, which to a large extent is quite legitimate, has really goes across the board. And I understand why people have to use some cliches in their parlance in order to make themselves credible, especially as far as the Jewish question is concerned, because in continental Europe, this legacy of anti-Semitism, this legacy of the Jewish question is very, very strong, and both on the left and on the right. So I guess I'm just trying to make myself a little bit clearer in terms of in terms of my terminology, because this is unfortunately not just us as activists, as nationalists, but also some big academics. They often make mistakes and big errors by not defining enough the words that they use in their treatises, in their pieces and articles.
No, okay, Tom. The before we leave this particular subject, political nationalism, behind, move on to the intellectual question. There's one other thing that I wanted to tack on, and it does tack on quite nicely. I mean, one of the difficulties in terms of arriving at a clear and concise terminology is that this is very much an emergent, instinctual response, a refinding of self that's occurring across all Europe and across the West generally for white peoples. And, you know, there's many rooms in the mansion. Some of those rooms don't really, at this stage, show an awful lot of connection to others. For example, you have the likes of UKIP and AfD in Germany, which principally are there to deal with the question of Europe and political internationalism, the dissolution of the nation state, the dissolution of democracy, and the march towards the globality and the eventual triumph of corporate interests, banking interests. And they're basically sort of, you know, complaining about that, but doing so obviously at a non-intellectual level, at a populist level, and they're doing well. You've also got in there movements like Pegida, like the English Defence League, which is pretty well dead now, which have had a different focus, an Islamic focus, a cultural focus, and a faith focus. And again, you know, make a great effort not to present themselves in any way as an easy target for the establishment. Fully understandable. For what they're trying to do, yet still they are generally seen as, and I think we have to view them as, part of our household. I certainly support UKIP and I will vote for UKIP. I want them to do as well as possible because my interest is in degrading the political class and degrading the political establishment, and I think that they're uniquely positioned to do that, definitely more so than any other movement in the British context. So, you know, one can support them in the hope that there will be something emerging later from their successes and that that will prove useful to us in a more direct way. And I've already, in a sense, answered my own question because I've told you that I regard them as being beneficial, but I would much rather hear how you respond to these groups.
Let's be frank. These are watered-down parties and positions. You mentioned the UKIP. I certainly have a great deal of respect for Farage, and I'm pretty much aware he's a smart guy. He's a good fox. He knows which lingo he has to use in the European Parliament and which on the Channel 4 in Great Britain. And, of course, he knows that there are certain limits. So the good thing is, okay, let's just give him credit for that. 5 or 6 years ago, this type of a lingo would have not had a free pass, would have not had a green card in the English media. So by stiff our head. The same goes for the AfD in Germany. Now, they've been under pressure, but they do have some representatives now in the federal parliament and also on the local level as well. So that certainly sounds like good news, but this is far from what I would personally endorse. I would certainly go with quote-unquote more radical type of a scenario. But given this over-oppressive, you know, Aurelian type of a, I don't even call it thought police, but rather forethought police or afterthought police, you know, all over Europe, you know, especially in media and in academia, you must truly be careful with what you say and how you say. And hence the reason I certainly would support the UKIP and the AFP. However, I mean, that always leaves us with this taboo zone, with this shut up word, you know, this is anti-Semitism and Semitism. For some reasons, everybody knows that there are certain zones that we are not supposed to cross. And this is something that also needs to be elucidated, namely the Jewish question in Europe, the Jewish question specifically in France, let alone in the United States of America. When will we define ourselves? Okay, let's call ourselves nationalists or identitarians, whichever. Let's say we are proud of our European and white heritage. But even when we frame that, there is always in the back of our mind this other with a capital O, and this is namely the Jew. And this is something that also needs to be, this relationship needs to be elucidated, cleared up a little bit. And I guess if you want to have a sound dialogue with them, you know, one way or another, it has to be broached, this topic. And frankly, I, for the time being, I don't know how it can be broached, but I know, you know, from historical perspective that if things are being pushed under the carpet, sooner or later they explode in a very nasty manner.
Well, I mean, I don't think it can be broached. I think that there is far too much to be gained out of the current movement of things. It's all going against us, and I'm sure that it's extremely satisfactory from a Jewish perspective. So, you know, there's no reason for them to wish to broach anything with nationalists. Why sit down and break bread with people who want to reverse all the progress you've seen generated? It doesn't make sense. And I just think we have to, personally, I think we have to ignore them as much as possible, while educating ourselves about the question, and get on with you know, shooting what foxes we can. There's a saying which says, first strangle the dog. You know, and that seems to me to be really where we're at the moment, politically. But intellectually, of course, it's another question altogether. The, you know, the world is made by political ideas, but before political ideas are philosophical ideas, and ultimately the most powerful voices in history are the intellectuals. So I come to the other half of this conversation, which I think is important, perhaps more important for us, because we would probably class ourselves as being more interested in thought rather than action. It doesn't mean we're not interested in action, by the way. You've obviously got a very good relationship with Alain de Beauvoir and other intellectuals across Europe, which is rare for anybody who's also involved in the American struggle. What's your take on live trends and directions intellectually? What's really hot? What's got mileage? What's got legs? And what's in a downward turn intellectually? What do you think the future holds for the movement? How's it going to be shaped by ideas coming forward?
Well, the one good thing I can say for sure, and I guess we could also offer some empirical evidence for it, that there has been, over the last couple of years, and you're of course also witnessing that in the United Kingdom, there is this gradual saturation with this political correctness, even among people who were at some point back 20 years or 30 years ago, the movers and shakers of, and the architects of this political correctness. So even there's more and more young people, of course, that are not often well-structured. They don't know exactly what they're after. But there has been a growth in nonconformism, if I can put it that way. So yes, in one sentence, the growth of nonconformism has been gaining momentum, and I'm quite hopeful, and I hope this will result in some political actions, or possibly it will have some political spillovers in on the local level, also on the
federal
level.
A lot of this is
going
into the left again, though, isn't it? I mean, you've got Syriza, which has been a big beneficiary.
Yes.
That's one of the
right,
problems.
But even here, we've got to be, again, very careful in terms of across-the-board labeling the Syriza, because the Syriza itself, you know, ironically, I must say that, ironically, paradoxically, it advocates, it endorses some elements, especially in the economy, which I'm fully supportive of. And both on a political level, they also have a couple of right-wingers in their coalition government. The big guy, the Minister of Defense, is a right-winger in the Syriza government. So I'm pretty much sure that even their intelligence has retained quite a few right-wingers there. So again, as far as the left, the true leftists, because I must say, with all due respect for my right-wingers and my nationalists, I've always had a respect, a decent amount of respect for true leftists. Not for this Mickey Mouse nationalist now in Nepal.
You know that I've been advocating redefining left for whites, a white left, that would be available to us for its definition to correct people when they say, what do you mean by white leftism? Well, we don't mean taking away private property. We don't mean striving after perfectly equal outcomes that have nothing to do with merit, and we don't mean importing foreigners into our unions, but we do take this perspective as it keeps an eye on elites and make sure that they're accountable and they're not traitorous to the rank and file, and to the rank and file as well, that they have incentive to participate. And this is the white leftist perspective, which the Jews don't want us to have. That's why they continually tried to label us as far right, because they know that disrupts the means of organizing ourselves.
I don't think that comes from Jews. It does in a way because it begins.
They're the ones who are labeling. Yeah, I mean, it didn't originate that way, but they've used that against us.
That's why they want to call us far rightists.
That's why they want us to identify as rightists, because it destroys our means to organize, and it destroys our means of accountability. And
Daniel, I agree with you, Daniel. You are quite right. In fact, again, we have to reposition ourselves. But before we reposition ourselves politically, we have to do it on a theoretical level and primarily on this linguistic level. I keep talking about the semiotics in a linguistic. It's very, very important.
Well, we can draw a distinction between a white left and a red left. The red left would be the Jewish left, and all the corruption, all this communist stuff that's led to so much destruction of our people and so much nonsense and pitting and using these victim groups against whites, white men in particular. So all that stuff has nothing to do with the white left, which is a union of Native Europeans, wherever they might be.
We just have to find the right language and the right way of putting it. To a large extent, I agree with you. In fact, again, we come to the starting point. I don't like being considered a right-winger. I was also raised in a family where even the word bourgeois, the capitalist, had a very negative connotation, despite the fact that we're all very conservative and Catholic in our family.
And at this point, it really should, because that's one of the prime vehicles of our destruction is international capitalism. So. Yes.
Absolutely. This is something we have to promote among quote-unquote right-wingers, our colleagues, specifically in the United States of America, where I know it from my first-hand experience. When you start, railing against capitalists, people look at you. Are you a Marxist? Are you a Maoist? Not at all. But I'm just saying the obvious thing. Being an anti-capitalist doesn't mean that you have to be pro-communist and vice versa. For me, at least, and I have a solid,
I agree with you.
Being anti-communist means first and foremost being an anti-capitalist as well.
Communism was the perfect capitalism in the end, in a way. I have to take occasion to make amends to Matt Parrott to some extent, because I've been razzing him a lot, but his critique of the mercantile culture that emerged from the Enlightenment and its taking down of the priestly class, their rule, I think he's really putting his finger on a really central and difficult problem, this mercantile culture that we're involved with.
Well, just to follow up on Alain de Benoist, and unfortunately he is still perceived, especially in the United States of America now, as being the proponent of Marxism. Now, he's definitely an anti-communist. But it certainly doesn't prevent him from being, accommodating, if I can use this word, to some excerpts, to some pieces, and to some theories by Marx. And I just in this recent editorial that I've translated for the Occidental Observer, Turning Point. In fact, I'm in touch almost on a regular basis with Alain de Benoist, so I know exactly where he's coming from. But this is something we have to address for this issue, precisely because we don't want to have young people, be they white English or be they, for that matter, white young German student. We don't want them to flock into some weird and bizarre type of a movement, anarchistic, violent, even converting themselves to Islam or Islamists. This seems to be a trend like in California and France now. So this is what's something a little bit scary. We just have to propose a lingo, a narrative, if I can use this big-time academic word, that would attract those young people. This is something we have to look. And at the same time, criticizing the legacy of communism, which ruined the mindset of the Russians and the Ukrainians, even if you wish, the Croats and the Serbs. But at the same time, reject this imported type of a Hollywood turbo capitalism, which is destroying the young Polish people. You know, the 500,000 of them now had to leave the country and live in the UK and elsewhere. I mean, this is a shame. You know, everybody, like, let me, if I can just digress just for 10 seconds. I mean, when you hear the news in the Herald Tribune and the Wall Street Journal about the quote-unquote the Polish miracle, well, what the heck are we talking about? The 500,000 young Poles had to leave Poland in order to put the food on the table. I mean, we're talking about the country which has been entirely colonized by big-time capitalism, big-time banks. This is the problem. Banking system, this is our main enemy.
Mm. But it's hard to tell Eastern Europeans that after the rebellion against communism that we have a different problem now. It's really
will understand that probably quite quickly because they are
very quickly.
I think they're starting to, but it's a bit late.
They're acculturated, aren't they, or enculturated rather, in a sort of political critique of great ideas and big movements and big facts, political facts. They've got that mindset established. By the years of communism, they can't very well put that aside and just sort of move into the sort of soporific world that Western Europe has inhabited during that period. While we had consumerism and we had the wonderful miracle years in Germany after the war and the hugely technologically advancing lifestyle and luxury everywhere, inconceivable luxury.
But going back to our what I'm calling our white left, we're not talking about nobody's against people having wealth and private property
No. But what I'm saying is that having established a critique, which is obviously gone deep down right to the bone, that's there, and it should be quite easy for them to cite international finance and global capital, and to be
well,
able
some
to
do, but how much, yeah, how much power exists. Do they have?
Well, I think that the problem really is masked by the fact that their life is becoming easier and easier and easier in terms of material necessities.
That's very true,
and that does make it more difficult for them to be critical. But but in the process, they will find that the democracy they were promised is actually stolen away from them, and they are going into a life which is still one of wage slavery. It just happens now to include compliant consumerism, whereas under the Soviet regime, it did not.
There's some awareness of that, but yeah, you're right. They're lulled by the
They're still lulled by this imagery of Hollywood and this vicarious computer system, unfortunately. But I'm glad that we have tackled this issue, folks, real briefly, because this is the general disease now all over Eastern Europe. Of course, it's much more visible, it's more salient than in Western Europe. But unfortunately, we have to face it. And I'm not ruling out some very serious social upheavals.
Yeah, Western Europe is already underwater, and Eastern Europe is like the ship, other ship pointing up, waiting to go down. And
there is a difference.
Waves along
there,
with the
there are several strands in this. If we're talking about technology, there's the effect of technology on the lived life and on identity, which Heidegger did a great deal to uncover. There is also the fact that technology is part of the Promethean nature of Europeans. It's part of our conflict with nature, without which we would not be where we are. We wouldn't have an average 100 IQ. We would not be geniuses, who've created all that we've created, who've got under the polar ice, who've gone to the moon. You know, none of these incredible things would have happened but for that Promethean attitude, which is extremely precious and unique. It doesn't exist amongst the other races of mankind. It does not exist amongst the Jews. It's ours. And if we're to be honest about the kind of life that we have, a great deal of it actually flows from that part of our essential nature. So we can't just say, it's all bad. The elements of it that are bad are the elements that are quite specific and are to do with power and control and are to do with the way that money, and Jewish money particularly, is used to move the West towards Olam Haba, and where power, corporate power, is used to move the whole world, actually, not just the West, towards the globality. You know, these things happen to be congruent. And that's why there is such a large crossover between the peoples who are, you know, who are involved in different parts of it. But, you know, and you could throw into the pot, you could throw Marxist utopia into the pot. You know, the utopians, they go along with it, although they're totally against global capital. They're nonetheless, they're happy to see these kind of advances because they want a post-racial utopia in the West. And so on and so forth. So, you know, all of these things, those we can identify, and those we can say, well, you know, ideologically, these belong to the sort of tendency to massify and the tendency to destroy identity and to take away from us what we are and how we really would express ourselves if we were only free to do so, if we were only free to stand in our own skin. And all of the rest of it, the general technology that you know, keeps us warm in winter and all the rest of it, that's fine. That's not oppressive in any way, and it's worthwhile having an economy that delivers as much of it as possible to as many. That's my attitude.
I liked very much your point about us being a Promethean and Faustian. This is something very, very European, very white, if I can put it bluntly. And I guess we certainly have to be proud of it, because no race, no nation, nobody has this Promethean spirit like us. And it truly reminds me of my readings of ancient myths and mythologies. Actually, my hero is Faust, and for that matter, even Prometheus. However, I must say, look, folks, and if we delve deeper into ourselves, and I hope I don't sound too philosophical, there is something strange with this European gene pool, and for that matter, with all of us. I mean, just as much as we are proud of our Faust, we got to also admit that we have our Titus Andronicus's, we have our Macbeths, we have our Curzon, our families, and this ties in with what I said at the beginning of the show. This is something that I cannot explain in our 10,000-year-old European history. For some reasons, even when we run out of bad guys, hypothetically speaking, if tomorrow, if we run out of Muslims, so if they depart from Europe, I mean, who can guarantee that we will not start again a 30-year war, a 50-year war, like they did in Titus Andronicus? I'm sure you're familiar with Macbeth as well, or Titus Andronicus, with family just killing each other. And for some reason, look at the American Civil War, look at the war in the Balkans, look at the war in the 30-year war. So I guess that is a real important question.
We don't need to be fighting each other. I think that there's an assumption among some people that this kind of vicious competition is like an inherent part of life, and it's assumed that it's necessary somehow. Where I don't believe that it is.
Can I just make a small point? Very small point, because I know we have very little time left, and I think it'll move us towards a good conclusion. It's often claimed that democracy is a tool of peace, because supposedly there's no two democracies have ever gone to war with one another. I'd like to make a small change to that as a nationalist, and I'd like to say that consciousness of self is the ultimate and really only genuine guarantor that we have. If we know ourselves, then we will not or fall prey to those who would take us into conflicts. To know oneself is to know one's true interests, and to know one's limitations, and also to know others. And I think that it is the foundation of all human understanding. And you know, it's on that basis, as a nationalist, that I believe that it is possible for peoples to live in peace. I don't believe it is possible for them to live in peace unless they're nationalists, which I'm saying, even though we haven't agreed terms about what nationalism is, but that nationalism as consciousness, rather than being under the sway of other forces and becoming unknown to yourself, a stranger to yourself, Nationalism is the...
I've written a piece recently for the Occidental Quarterly where I'm, you know, quoting some guys who are dealing with this issue on the theoretical level of democracy. I'm quoting a book, and unfortunately hasn't been translated into English, La Mystique Démocratique by Louis Rougier. He's a great guy who's actually analyzing this phenomenon, rather the fraud of democracy, from the linguistic perspective and how this word has been misused. So yes, I prefer the word nationalism, having in mind always that this resonance of the word in the ears of my opponents and interlocutors. So we always got to put things in the right perspective. Well,
nationalism is the broader term. It's the parent term. I would probably describe myself as an identitarian.
But the Jews are going to try to, they're always going to construe nationalism as imperialism. They're going to say, they're going to take it and they're going to say, what you mean by nationalism is imperialism, when that's not what you mean.
I tell them they're racial nationalists.
Regarding democracy, isn't it, if there's going to be a democracy, it doesn't have to be within a manageable sized group of people who are accountable to certain common grounds and standards.
Well, democracy is an excellent system for feeding interests into the political class. It just has to be secured to make sure that that is the only way that it operates. As soon as the political class start to have the idea that it's their interests which, you know, actually count, then there is no more democracy anymore. It's become a pretense. We go to vote, but what difference does it make? Because the show goes on.
It's got to begin with littler groups, yeah?
No, I don't think it's group size. I think it's a question of the process itself. I think that if ethnic interest... The only group involved is the ethnic group.
It must have to do with size to some extent. It has to.
The only group involved is the ethnic group. I mean, in nationalism, we seek to cohere what can be cohered and to exclude what can't. So, for example, in the American context, you cannot include the interests of black Americans and the interests of white Americans in one polity in an honest sense. What you can do is to represent the interests of one group or the other, assuming that this is the right basis on which one analyzes these groups. Of course, in the American context, constitutionalism or whatever, we're told that it's values and patriotism and... these superficial things that unite. Well, I just think that's a deception.
We've opened up a can of worms here.
It's not a problem in Europe, is it? Because in Europe, you know, we know perfectly well that it is the ethnic group, it is the people of the land, which matters. You know, Tom's own part of the world has been through this terrible business in the 1990s, which exposed that most brutally, that in the end, peoples turn back to their own groups and their own soil, and they will do whatever they have to secure those two things. The identity is clear, it's the group, and the process is simply one which has to feed the group's interests into the political life of the nation. Then everything's fine. Democracy works. Democracy works better than anything else.
Fine, folks, just before, I will have to sign off shortly. Shall we round it up?
Okay.
We have a few more questions and...
Well, I just want to go back to very last question, really, was also the first question I asked, because we haven't quite got to it in this section of the interview. I count myself as being somebody who kind of yearns for a new overview, an intellectual overview, a competitor thought world to the one that we ordinarily inhabit, the one that we got from Christianity, and Christianity got it from Judaism. You know, it's liberalism. And we have this general system which has birthed everything, Marxism included, has birthed everything that exists for us, really, in terms of the way we live and the way we think, and the kinds of futures that our people are unfortunately going to suffer at the moment. So I see this as a systemic problem. Now, you know this is true because we sat down at Gatwick Airport some 6 years ago, and we talked about this problem. And I was very keen then to try to find some way of getting people to cooperate together and form a think tank that might have might make some progress with it. But I see us as more salami sliced, you know, more separated out than ever. And what we need is the opposite. We need a grand idea that we can coalesce around and develop as our primary principle. I'm just wondering, you know, whether there are people out there who you've met who are thinking in a blue sky sense along those lines, and whether you are aware of anything that might be emergent and useful.
Well, that's a tough question, which certainly, I guess that's your approach now, the issue, you have addressed the issue, I'm sorry, of character and ego, and I guess that's something that also needs to be solved in our quote-unquote rank and file. And I guess this is probably one of the major issues that needs to be solved, how to line up people who will put the interests of their community, or let's say it bluntly, of our racial survival above their private pecuniary interests, or for that matter, above their private local agenda. Of course, there are some people whose work I like, who have some good thoughts, and who are definitely who have made some breakthroughs, but whose ego is probably like the Cologne Cathedral or like the Abbey, you know, yeah. and vice versa. There are some very mild people, good people, who for some reasons, for whatever, don't want to come out, don't want to elbow their way through because they're too nice and too kind. I don't want to say that I'm an introverted person. I'm trying to combine both, and there's a huge potential. I'm not so much concerned with our numbers, you know. And in fact, even the dwindling numbers of our populace, be it in Leeds or Manchester or in San Francisco or in L.A., which is a hellhole anyway. And again, what I'm interested in is the people of character. So I guess I'm a little bit, you're right, you really got me here on spot, because I don't want to say that I've sort of secluded myself. I'm meeting people on the daily level. I've traveled around Europe and so on. But it's more and more difficult for me to find people of character, you know, really committed people. I guess this obnoxious individualism, which to a large extent is also mixed with consumerism, is preventing us from our common solidarity. How can I put it? From our common whole. So I guess let me illustrate this with our show. Just as much as I certainly appreciate being on your show, and I hope I'm going to be next time as well.
You will.
We just have to be more alive. I just don't want to talk to the computer. I want to talk to live people, living human beings sitting next to me, having an eye-to-eye contact with them. This is how we can possibly make some changes, and I'm pretty much sure it can be done.
I think that there's very little time left to us, maybe 20, 25 years, when people will have to be talking about a different kind of solution entirely. So it's more urgent and pressing than ever that people who have intellectual capability and who, as you say, have goodness and clearness of purpose are able to create and contribute and to know that their work will be taken up by others and not simply rejected because it was essentially because it was originated by somebody else. I think that is a problem. I think there are, as you say, a lot of egoists around. But, you know, you're not one of them, Tom. I've known you a long time. And, you know, of all the people that in this movement that I've come across, you're one of the most warm-hearted and best men. And I'm very, very proud to call you a friend. And I hope we have the opportunity to talk again very soon. Thank you very, very much indeed.
By all means, and listen, my best wishes, and I'm at your service, and also I'm at the service of your colleagues and comrades, and if they're serious, if they're people of character, if they're people of, regardless of their background, I don't care about this, as long as they belong to our gene pool, as long as they share our culture, I'm always willing to help. I'm not asking for any honoraria. What I wish is just to function with normal people. The same goes also to Daniel. Daniel, I hope I will be in Poland because I've received some invitations. So
great.
I'm pretty much sure we'll be in touch. And guys, if you want to schedule another show, let's say, you know, I'm now re-immersed again in Shakespeare and the concept of the tragic. I'm reading some German stuff as well from Goethe and Schiller, you know, my favorite.
So well, that would be interesting.
So we don't need to recite. We always talk about the Jews and the race.
I know.
Can find all this stuff, believe it or not, when you read Shakespeare, when you read Othello, when you read the Merchant of Venice, you can find all those answers about the Jews, or for that matter, immigrants, or for that matter, this guy Aaron, you know Aaron from Titus Andronicus, Aaron was a Moor, you know, was actually courting this white lady, the God lady. So you can find all those damn answers among classics. So we got lots of things. So we just need to show our people, folks, that we are not some extraterrestrial computer guys. We just people. That's why I'd like to talk to you live now, face to face. And
to do that, Tom, is perfectly possible. You'd have to come to my house. I've got a very good recording system. Here, which was bought because my daughter, I don't know if you remember, she was a pianist. And
I remember her very well.
We can easily record. You've only got to say you want to come over and we'll do it that way. I don't know how we get Daniel over here. Perhaps we'd have to have him on Skype anyway.
Yes. And all the right. Same goes to Daniel. It's like, if I can be of any assistance, as long as we fight for our cause.
No. All right. All the best,
Thanks, Tom. Very much, Tom.
Talk to you soon.
Thank you very much, folks, for the invitation.